sattvika, in the mode of goodness. Karika, the performer of activities. Asanghi, free from attachment. Raga anda, blinded by personal desire. Rajasa, the performer in the mode of passion. Smritaha, is considered. Tamasa, the performer in the mode of ignorance. Smriti, from remembrance of what is what. Vibrastaha, fallen. Igunaha, transcendental. Matapasaha, he who has taken shelter of me. Translation. A worker free of attachment is in the mode of goodness. A worker blinded by personal desire is in the mode of passion. And a worker who has completely forgotten how to tell right from wrong is in the mode of ignorance. But a worker who has taken shelter of me is understood to be transcendental to the modes of nature. Purport. A transcendental worker performs his activities in strict accordance with the directions of Lord Krishna and the Lord's bona fide representatives. Taking shelter of the Lord's guidance, such a worker remains transcendental to the material modes of nature. Let's read the verse again. Sattvika karako sanghi ragando rajasasmita tamasasmiti vibrasto nigano madhapasaya. A worker free of attachment is in the mode of goodness. A worker blinded by personal desire is in the mode of passion. And a worker who has completely forgotten how to tell right from wrong is in the mode of ignorance. But a worker who has taken shelter of me is understood to be transcendental to the modes of nature. So, here in this chapter, Krishna is pointing out to Uddhava how to recognize the when one is associating with the modes of material nature and when one is acting in such a way that one is transcendental to the modes of material nature. And then even more specific knowledge is if one is associating with the modes of material nature, which particular material modes of nature is one associating with? So Krishna is pointing this out. Although the modes of material nature or being transcendental to them, although it's the basis of every action we perform, it's the basis of the faith that we have, it's the basis of our religious principles, it's the basis of our determination, it's the basis of the food we eat, it's the basis of everything we do. But how many people in this world stop to think which mode of material nature am I, you know, operating in at this particular moment? You know, who stops to ever think like that? Although it's very clearly pointed out in the scriptures that if we operate in the mode of ignorance, we'll get a result of distress. If we operate in the mode of passion, we'll get a mixed result. Some temporary limited happiness mixed in with our suffering. And if we operate in the mode of goodness, we're able to tolerate the suffering and become a little peaceful. They're all actually different degrees of suffering. who stops to think? Before I do this activity or take up this religious process or eat this food, am I doing something in the mode of ignorance which is going to cause me distress? And then, am I doing something in the mode of ignorance and is going to cause me bondage in the material world? So we see here that in the mode of passion, it's described that the word raga andaha, a worker blinded by personal desire, is in the mode of passion. So when we see in the Bhagavad Gita that if we associate with a particular mode of material nature and then we become attracted to enjoy something in this material world, and then we may develop a particular desire to enjoy something in this world, gradually that desire has the potential to take away our intelligence, because that desire becomes so overwhelming that we think of nothing more than fulfilling that particular desire. And therefore, perhaps we may have had good instruction even from the Shastras previously, from parents, from things that we've read, things that we've experienced. We may have good experience that, even having this material desire, already there is suffering. The peacefulness is immediately gone. As soon as there is strong material desires, one immediately loses any chance of being peaceful. Just having the desire, and then of course trying to act upon that desire, the problems of trying to make that desire manifest gradually increase. And of course when the result comes, there can be, there's a reaction of all our activities, there's a mixed happiness. But we become so blinded by the desire to get the result that our intelligence, which may be somewhere in the back of our consciousness, knocking, don't do this, don't do this. Actually, this is a concept that even children understand. I don't know, those who were brought up watching the Flintstones when I was a little child, the Flintstones are like little cavemen. So Fred Flintstone, he was a caveman. Sometimes when he wanted to do something which was a bit naughty, Fred Flintstone would appear beside him, representing the bad side of his mind, and little like demon tail, like he was like the devil. And then on the other side was Fred Flintstone with a little angel, telling him, "Don't do it. Think of the consequences." So actually, children watch these shows, and children understand that within the mind there's this battle going on between the intelligence and the mind, which is just ready to do something. So, it's there. It's an innate understanding from the very beginning of life that when there's a strong desire to do something, we don't always listen to our intelligence. And even a 5-year-old child would actually understand that. It's not knowledge which is somehow out of the reach of the common man. Yet, how many people stop and think, they may not know that type of activity may be called Rajaguna, or they may not necessarily entitle it the mode of passion, but they know that they're in that mood, that yes, I've got this strong desire and I'm not inclined to listen to my intelligence. They know that. We know that that's called Rajaguna. They may not have a name for it, but they know that they're existing in that mode. So the intelligence just, you know, is forced to just be blocked out. And although the intelligence is saying that, you know, if you do this, so many difficulties, so many problems, so much suffering, and then what happens, of course, is there is suffering. Now, the mode of ignorance is an even more intense stage of that process. We see in the Bhagavad Gita that it describes the mode of ignorance when that desire becomes more intense. It manifests as greed and anger. So the greed and anger are forms of lust in a more intense form. And that more intense form of lust is the mode of ignorance. Greed and anger manifest. So we can imagine if one is or in the mode of passion, one is considered to be blinded. Blinded means they're not seeing through their intelligence anymore, so they're blinded. Then how much darkness there is in the mode of ignorance when that strong desire has intensified to the point of, you know, greed, powerful greed, you know, and anger. How many people in the world stop you know, to some degree, and you know, really evaluate properly each and every action, their mode of worship, the foods they're eating. You know, people that actually, as described by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura in one of his songs, actually the people of the world are carried away by the waves of Maya. They're carried away by the, you know, strong waves of the modes of material nature. It doesn't happen. therefore, we now one in the mode of goodness, they will stop and think, and they will listen to their intelligence. They will listen to Shastra. They will listen to good advice, and they will control the mind, control the senses, and in that way. Become somewhat detached, even though the mind and the senses are, you know, pushing in a certain way, the mode of goodness, they will actually restrain them, their mind and the senses, and act in a way which is conducive for living peacefully in the world, for executing their duties according to religious principles, executing their duties according to their position, whether they're a family man or in the renounced sort of life, whether they're a business person or a leader or a worker. So they will perform those duties without attachment, knowing that just following the dictates of the mind and senses without listening to good intelligence leads to suffering. So that is very rare. In especially in Kali Yuga, those in the mode of goodness who do that, very, very rare. But those who are transcendental, their process is that they will only do something if Krishna authorizes it. And they're not necessarily acting out of a sense of trying to be detached from the material world, although that may be there in the beginning. In the beginning, one may, even as a devotee, try and act as trying to be detached from the material world so that one can avoid bondage and suffering and, you know, repeated birth and death. But as a devotee progresses in their devotional service, they're acting more out of just attachment for Krishna, that because of their love for Krishna and because of Krishna's love for them, they just want to please Krishna by doing what he authorizes, what Krishna wants. And that way they're automatically detached from the material world and the modes of nature, even the mode of goodness, without even separately endeavoring, just trying to execute Krishna's orders. So this is... So the difficulty is, of course, that in Kali Yuga, everyone is born Sudra. So the difficulty is, of course, that even the so-called Brahmanas in Kali Yuga are really, the mode of goodness is very difficult, in fact impossible, you know, even for the Brahmanas to maintain. And we see that in most cases, more and more, they're also becoming influenced by the modes of passion and ignorance. They're not able to purify themselves. When we say Brahmanas, not just referring to the Brahmins in India, but we're talking about the clergy from, you know, practically all the religious institutions in the world are struggling. For the Christian priests, they have, places for alcoholic priests, where there are thousands, they have thousands of customers, we see, the so-called Brahmanas, the so-called clergy, in most, all of the religious institutions of the world, actually struggling to maintain the mode of goodness which the priest should be operating on. And in most cases, therefore, they're really operating in the modes of passion and ignorance. And therefore, we see that they're not able to purify themselves, and we see that the mode of worship that they're recommending to their followers is a mode of worship which is symptomatic of the modes of ignorance and passion. And therefore we see that the followers of so-called religion these days, predominantly they all eat meat, which is an activity in the mode of ignorance. They, as far as celibacy or, maintaining sex life for the purpose of bringing children into the world, otherwise abstaining, we see that they're allowing more and more, freedom within the religious institutions and even amongst the priests, because they can't control, so therefore they adopt it as part of their religious process. So people come to ask, how do I worship God? And they give them a process which is actually saturated with the modes of passion or ignorance. Therefore in Kali Yuga, the only real hope is to take shelter of one who's taken shelter of Krishna. Unless you take shelter of someone who's taken shelter of Krishna and become transcendental to the modes, you cannot act just trying to maintain the mode of goodness. That's the point. In Kali Yuga, if someone is trying to remain a religious person or trying to be a religious follower of such a so-called religious person, just maintaining principles in the mode of goodness, ultimately they'll not be able to do that because it's the very nature of Kali Yuga, and all their activities will just very quickly degenerate to the modes of passion and ignorance. So really, in Kali Yuga, unless one becomes a devotee of Sri Krishna by the grace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and actually tries to transcend the modes of material nature, they have very little hope of becoming free from the bondage of the modes of material nature, especially the lower modes of material nature. So we see that devotees, they're very careful to, as it's described in the purport here, A transcendental worker performs his activities in strict accordance with the directions of Lord Krishna and the Lord's bona fide representatives. So very strict. We see, you know, this is one thing that Srila Prabhupada taught us, that, you know, unless something is actually confirmed by Shastra and Guru Sadhu Shastra, it cannot be accepted. Now, you see that in many circumstances when people may have asked Srila Prabhupada a question, and Srila Prabhupada could have answered it from his own position as an eternal servant of Krishna. He could just use his own position as an exalted authority to literally answer that question, and then people would have just accepted him as the authority. But he very rarely did that, although he could have. You know, he's a personal associate of Krishna, and he could have just answered from that point, but he didn't. He answered from Shastra. because what would happen, of course, is that even within ISKCON, as devotees become elevated, which they naturally do, but still there's a danger that one thinking one is elevated may then give one's own, you know, just personal opinion or realizations without necessarily backing things up with Shastra, you know, Sadhu and Guru, and that's the beginning of the end of the Parampara system. So Srila Prabhupada is very careful, and we should follow very, very carefully follow that mood of Srila Prabhupada. That, you know, unless something is, you know, can be confirmed by Shastra, that shouldn't be done. Today, you know, today I've been discussing over the last few days, it's an interesting time. We were discussing this yesterday a little bit. I'm still trying to come to speaking with the different sadhus and Shastri quotes, come to an understanding. Today is Ram Chandra Vijayatsava. Who, everyone agree? Yeah. Alright, so far we're doing okay. Previously, you know, I've always been told, well, let me ask you, what do we celebrate today? Ram Vijayatsava. What do we celebrate? What's that?
Dashaya.
What is that?
Victory of good over evil.
The victory of good over evil. Why is that? What happened to what event took place that makes us celebrate that?
Ravana was killed.
Okay. That's what I've always understood. Who else understands that today? Yeah? Okay. What? Yeah. Now, I was reading in the notes in for the Vaishnava calendar. This is my confusion, which hopefully someone can help me clear it up, but it says there that this is the day that Hanuman told Ram the news that he had found Sita, and therefore they performed a celebration to commemorate that they'd found Sita. And of course the war happened after that. Yeah. No?
Lord Rama killed Ravana and then he did
Okay.
That's the reason why you have effigies in India of, yes, you know, Ram and the satellite. And
yes, no, I understand. Ram, yeah, Ram killed. Ram,
they burned the effigy.
What's that?
They burned the effigy of Ram.
Yes.
Artificial Ram is, yes, huge. And then they burned it.
They do that today, yes. So are they doing that according to Shastra or according to custom? That's what I'm asking. Right? Let's just have a look at some of the things. I mean, I was looking at the, Ramayana. Today is Ram Vijayotsava, and on the Amavasya, which is about 21 days from now, Ram returns to Ayodhya. Correct? How long did it take Ram to return to Ayodhya? What's that? How did Ram go back to Ayodhya? The Pushpaka. He wanted to go straight back. He went back on the Pushpaka, which is the chariot stolen from Kavira by Ravana. And he wanted to go straight back to Ayodhya. Right. So, does that mean it took him 21 days? Or, you know, let's say the next day there was the funeral ceremonies, and the next day they quickly coronated Vibhishan. So there's about 19 days unaccounted for. What happened? Did it take him and that Pushpaka 19 days? That doesn't make sense. Some of the things I looked at. One, from the time when Ram heard the news, Vibhishan arrived. After Vibhishan arrived, Ram sat and meditated before the ocean for 3 days, right? And then it took them 5 days to build the bridge. They crossed, and then there was a battle. Part of the battle with Indrajit, took 3 days, and Ravana was killed, I'm pretty sure on the same day. Looking at that timing, it looks like about 15, 16 days, which would still leave about 6 days, in which case Ram, then perform, tidying up affairs in Sri Lanka, would then go back to Ayodhya. I mean, that's how it appears. And, so that, what I'm saying is, that tallies with what they said in the Vaishnava calendar, that Ram Vijayotsava, they're celebrating they declared on that day, of course, that yes, now Ravana will be killed because we know where he is, and Sita has been found. Sita will be saved. So they declared that will happen. So can anyone with absolute authority say that on the Ram Vijayotsava, it's the day that Ravana was killed? Can someone back that up with Shastra? Or can anyone say with absolute authority that Ram Vijayotsava is the day that Hanuman received news of Sita's being found, and then the war took place after that? Who can say with absolute authority? Okay. They're all a little silent. I'm not sure. I'm asking because I've always had the same understanding as what you're saying until I read that in the Vaishnava calendar, and then I went through the Ramayana, and it sort of, the timing fits in. So anyway, some of the pundits may have to research that to find out, to make sure that we're actually, it's very easy to, as you can see, very easy for the modes of material nature to kick in. And of course, as we described, we can't say that because all the people who are in the modes of passion and ignorance on this day perform this particular ceremony, that therefore that's conclusive proof that this is, what it is. Because as we've seen, the people who are blinded by the modes of passion and ignorance, in fact, many people throughout India actually, sometimes I ask them, what are you doing today? Or, we're worshipping Durga, and I say, not Ram Vijayatsava. As for many of them, it's Ram Vijayatsava doesn't even enter the mind because of the strong material desires. All they can think of is Durga Puja. And even then, there's a lot of differences as to how that's done. Some fast throughout the whole Navratri. Some begin Durga Puja on the Shasti. So Navratri is from Patipat to Navami. Some begin Durga Puja on the Shasti, the sixth day. Some begin on the seventh day. Some on the eighth day. Some fast the whole time. Some fast just on the Ashtami. And then today they actually have big festival for Durga as well. Although in our Vaishnav calendar, Durga Puja is on the Saptami. So again, and we know that, for instance, we cannot say that, just like if we become a Christian, we would say that, yes, it's okay to eat meat, because everyone is doing it. But only one, voice in the wilderness, Srila Prabhupada, said, no, that's not right. the whole world may say that that is actually the teachings of Lord Jesus, but I say you're all wrong. I challenge everyone in the world, you're wrong, because Krishna says something different. See, Srila Prabhupada was very bold like that. Srila Prabhupada was actually, always sort of like a little child holding the father's hand. He would give that opinion, example that sometimes a little child, they're holding their father's hand and they will challenge some grown-up. You go away from here, like that, because they're holding the father's hand. So they're very, but by themselves, they wouldn't dare. So Srila Prabhupada, because he never ever did anything which he, wasn't 100% sure that, yes, Krishna, this is Krishna's instruction, and understanding that this is Krishna's instruction, he would challenge the entire world. The scientists, the politicians, everybody. The masses of people, everyone. So everyone is saying, we can eat meat. It's in our scripture. And Srila Prabhupada is saying, no, it's not in your scripture. You're changing your scripture because you are blinded by your material desires. So, we have to be very careful. Whether it's a Hindu, a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, even the Buddhists eat meat nowadays. It's throughout so many different religious movements in the world, sinful activity is rife. It's an epidemic. Sinful activity is practiced daily, basically on the authority of their religion. People are so foolish. In Kali Yuga, people have very little intelligence. They're almost mad with material desires. The other day I saw a report that in England, the latest studies show that women who are pregnant, it's okay for them to drink intoxication in moderation. Have you seen that report? Yeah, there's a couple of days coming out. The days ago, that if a so of course a lot of laymen, what to speak of, even medical people in Australia and elsewhere around the world are sort of a bit shocked, that, and they're looking at what sort of people did you examine, what are the parameters of this sort of study and what have you, but you're encouraging now that women who are pregnant, it is okay to drink in moderation. That's the scientific medical fact that is now being presented around the world. And, you know, people are just soaking this up. Yes, yes, well, you know, if it's if they're saying, you know, but as we say, even, you know, the average, if someone has, you know, someone doesn't have to be a great scholar, but if they, you know, have just a normal intelligence that hasn't been, you know, obliterated by intoxication and illicit sex and, you know, massive amounts of, you know, anxiety and, you know, blinded by the most, you know, just the ordinary amount of logic and common sense, one would, you know, understand if a woman is pregnant, don't take intoxication. You know, be very careful what you put, because that baby, you know, it is going into their system. But here's, you know, the medical profession say, no, 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 we've done our tests. You can drink in moderation. So, you know, the state of madness, how people become so blinded. So, you know, again, you know, whether one is a Hindu, Muslim, so we have to be very careful. Am I doing this activity because I'm following the Hindus? Am I doing this activity because I'm following the Christians? Am I doing this activity because I'm following the atheists? You know, am I doing this activity because I'm following this? Or, you know, as we do, as Prabhupada did, am I doing this activity because I'm following Prabhupada? You know, there's so many different, and even then, you know, Srila Prabhupada was a little concerned that sometimes devotees would say, oh, Prabhupada said, you know, oh, Prabhupada said this. And sometimes, you know, you hear that. So someone says, the other day, there was I did a program at someone's house, and there was a boy there who was about 13. And he'd come along, because his friend was there, and his friend's father was the one I was doing the program for. He had a Shalagram Sheila, a Lakshmi Narayan Sheila. He was asking me, is that a real Sheila? Because he didn't know. And I said, yes, 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 it's a real Sheila. I'm thinking, you know, hope you know how to handle him. And anyway, he said, yes, we worship Radha Krishna and we also follow the instructions of Buddha. And I thought, well, you know, that's that's a little incompatible. You know, Buddha is saying that Krishna doesn't exist. Anyway, I tried to discuss that a little bit as I'm setting up, and one of the boys, he said, I read in the Bhagavad Gita that, you know, he said some funny thing, you know, by performing, you know, proper karmas, we can become equal with Krishna, you know, some statement like that, you know, it's a real Mayavadi statement. And I said, oh, you've read that in the Bhagavad Gita, yes, yes, yes. So I passed him my Bhagavad Gita. I said, can you find that and show me that? So, you know, he flicked through and he's searched through, you know, and, you know, the sweat started to run and his mother's looking, you know, is he going to find it? Because, you know, he couldn't find it. I said, I've read Bhagavad Gita, you know, a few times and I've never come across that statement, you know. So then I read a statement from chapter 2, verse number 12, how Krishna says actually we're all eternal individuals in the past, present and future. So people quote Bhagavad Gita, people quote Prabhupada. You know, there's a statement I often hear that if someone has a baby girl, they say, oh, you know, your wife was more lusty. Therefore, Prabhupada said, you know, if the wife's more lusty, then, you know, you have a baby girl. So, I've seen that lecture, and I'm not sure they actually even use the word lusty. According to, you know, strong desires. So therefore what happens is the devotees take, you know, that person, that devotee, they start looking at that devotee as a lusty person. So that's how they're saying it. They've taken that statement of Prabhupada and thrown it back that here this devotee is lusty. Like that. Prabhupada was really using it in the sense that, you know, devotees can have strong desires. So, you know, maybe, you know, one is desiring a girl strongly and one is desiring a boy strongly, for, you know, that may be there. But that doesn't mean the devotees are lusty. You know, someone may be happy to have a little girl or a little boy, you know, raise them as a devotee. That doesn't make that devotee a lusty person. So, but, you know, Prabhupada said, so on the authority of Prabhupada, you know, we can sort of say, oh, this devotee is lusty, that devotee is this. So there are, you know, a lot of things that we see happen. Sometimes because things have been done a certain way, a devotee may take over a service, and things have sometimes been done in a certain way for a certain amount of time, and you know they may just continue that. And because it's been done for a certain, and then the next devotee takes over that service, they do that in that way. So something becomes established as a standard. Oh, it's always been done this way. You know, that's another way that. Therefore, it becomes, this is Prabhupada's standard because it's always been done this way. And there's no looking into the original devotee who established that procedure. Was he strictly following Prabhupada, or was he just a little bit of speculation? And therefore, he's done something. The next person has done the same, and it's become Prabhupada's standard in ISKCON. There have to be a little careful, because Srila Prabhupada, it's actually good to maintain Srila Prabhupada's standard, but we first have to understand what that standard is. Srila Prabhupada said, what the nature of the mind, here we see that in the modes of passion and ignorance, you know, there are strong desires for sense gratification. And one of the ways we enjoy sense gratification is to have, you know, always something new. That is, you know, the nature of the mind. Therefore, you see that even, you know, people are married and, you know, the men are looking to other women, you know, something new. The women are looking to other men, something new. you know, different forms of, you know, there's got to be a new car every couple of years, you know, the car that we've got. We'll put ourselves in debt for so many years, but for the sense gratification, we get a new car. You know, I have to work so hard, but I've got a new car. You know, nothing wrong with the old car. But it's the nature of sense gratification, you know, just always. And he said that, you know, he said sometimes we see, you know, where perhaps, you know, the mind of a devotee even sometimes is not fully controlled, that as soon as that he puts them in charge of something, then immediately they want everything new. Everything the Prabhupada has established, everything, you know, some other devotees established, they want to, you know, change that and everything new. Sometimes you see that at Gopal's. Sometimes it's a good thing. I know I had that experience. when I managed Gopals for a couple of years in New Zealand. And when I took it over, it was in debt. When I finished management, I had $40,000 in the bank for Gopals. So then the next manager came along and he immediately spent that $40,000 to decorate, and then gradually they went back into debt. I know on the farm there, I lived on the Auckland farm for 10 years, collecting for the big temple. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. Although I've never seen it. And there were several orchards, beautiful orchards, and a new devotee, you know, or someone was given charge, and they took out all the plants. I've seen this happen even on New Vashan, New Underground. Ripped out the orchard, you know, put in all flowers and something. You know, orchards, of course, take many years. And then someone else comes along, takes out all the flowers, you know, after a couple of years, puts in a new orchard. Like this. Everything just been. Which if Srila Prabhupada, you know, saw that, just he would just consider that sense gratification, that just changing, you know, without. Prabhupada was very, very careful that even in Sydney one time, you know, in the early days they had a temple there. There was sort of a tree that used to sort of grow over the path in the backyard, and you had to sort of walk around it off the path, sort of thing. And Prabhupada, so they used to, when Prabhupada came the next time, they'd actually cut that tree down so that you could walk on the path. Prabhupada was so disturbed that they did that. Is it, you know, just so you know, certainly one should be very, very careful not to change Prabhupada's standard, because Prabhupada considered that just the activity of the mind acting for sense gratification, even though it appears that someone's doing some wonderful big managing, you know, someone's taking some big managerial position and doing so many wonderful things, getting things done, or he's a real doer, isn't he? But according to Prabhupada's, you know, mentality, you know, thinking, that in many cases that can be sense gratification. It's not very applaudable at all. But although keeping things the same, we should understand that, is this what we are taking as a standard? Can we confirm that this is the standard? So once the first establishing that, yes, this is Prabhupada's standard, now let's maintain it. Be very careful of changing things. So, you know, this is, if we do that, then we're acting for Krishna's benefit, for Srila Prabhupada's benefit, and that is above the modes of mature nature. But even as a devotee, as Prabhupada pointed out, it's still, our devotion can be mixed with the modes of mature nature, the mind still acting, you know, for sense gratification in a subtle way, even on high managerial positions. You know, so the only way we can guarantee, because unless one is Krishna conscious, one is sure to be influenced by the modes of lower modes of nature. But even as a devotee, one should be very careful that what I am doing is this. What is the authority? You know, is there authority from Srila Prabhupada, from Shastra, in our Krishna consciousness movement, that this is the thing to do, this is the way to do it, this is the person to do it, this is the time it should be done, and this is the mood it should be done in? All those things, you know, we understand from Srila Prabhupada. And that's how devotees act. For the non-devotees, that whole concept is a horrible, horrible thought. For the non-devotees, they like to, you know, sort of wing it. That's somehow there's this, they feel that is the liberated position. That is the, you know, elevated position. Just like there was one American rap singer, and so, you know, he was saying that, you know, rap music is spiritual music because it just flows automatically, you know, just without thinking and without, you know, just sort of flows out your mouth and like that. So, you know, we know rap music, they, you know, all sorts of things, you know, horrible, nasty things come out of their mouth. But because, you know, it just flows, you know, without any restraint, that's what people consider spiritual. And the same with sex life. That's what people consider. That they feel that, you know, they have love, and our relationship has elevated to a spiritual platform if there's no restriction on their sex life. And as soon as there's some restriction, they feel that the love or the spirituality has somehow been crippled. At this, you know, whereas the devotees think from the opposite point, you know, that unless it's sanctioned by Krishna, there's no question of spirituality. Like that. So this verse here is describing, I'll read it again, Sattvika kariko sanghi ragando rajasasmita tamasasmiti vibrasto nigano madhapasaya. A worker free of attachment is in the mode of goodness, a worker blinded by personal desires in the mode of passion, and a worker who has completely forgotten how to tell right from wrong is in the mode of ignorance. But a worker who has taken shelter of me is understood to be transcendental to the modes of material nature. There's any questions or comments here?
Would you like to hear something
about Madhvacharya? Madhvacharya, yes, it's his appearance day. Well, Madhvacharya, of course, was one of the acharyas of the four sampradayas. So again, it's a related topic, because in India there are four sampradayas, four Vaishnava sampradayas. One coming from Lord Brahma, in which Madhvacharya was the predominant acharya, around about the 13th century, I believe it was. And then there is a sampradaya, Vaishnava sampradaya, coming from Lakshmi, Sri Sampradaya, and Ramanujacharya was a predominant acharya. And then there is a sampradaya coming from Lord Shiva, of whom Vishnu Swami is the predominant acharya. And then there's a sampradaya coming from the four Kumaras, of whom Nimbarkacharya is a predominant acharya. The Mayavadis, or the impersonalists, also have a sampradaya, and that is coming in the line of Sankaracharya. He's the acharya. Unless one's mantra and you know, activities are actually, and you know, spiritual activities, sadhana, authorized by one of those sampradayas, they're considered to be, they have no standing. They're considered to be completely bogus. You know, that is. Of course, these days, you know, if someone says, you know, people don't have to be in a sampradaya, they just, you know, people just, it means nothing. That just like, you know, a medical school, you know, we know that you have to have been trained in the medical profession in some authorized sampradaya institution of, you know, educational system. And you have to be able to trace that person's education, you know, right through. In the future, more and more, that will not be there. That people will practice medicine, and, you know, training certificates will mean nothing in the future. You know that, and that is the state of spiritual life at the moment. That training, you know, authorization, authorized educational spiritual institution means nothing. We, you know, in this province we do this. My grandmother taught me. Her grandmother taught me. In this province we do. What is your sampradaya? No, we don't. We just follow this in this part, of, you know, in this village. So that is the way things are happening. So Madhvacharya, a very great, powerful personality. He took initiation at the age of 5 years old. By 12 years old, he'd taken sannyas and was preaching, all over India. You know, he studied personally under Srila Vyasadeva. Very, very, very powerful personality. I think one of his disciples was attacked by a tiger, and he just, you know, with his bare hands, he just killed that tiger. You know, he would put his toe on the ground, and he would challenge the strongest men. You know, you just try and lift my toe. You know, they couldn't budge it at all. You know, he just put his toe there. He's just so powerful personality. It is these great personalities, the acharyas, who are authorized to lead people. You know, they're very significant, powerful personalities in all rights. Nowadays, people don't want a leader at all. They feel that spirituality means not to be guided by others. Basically, it comes from in here without, you know, any guide from other people. Some devotees used to, you know, sometimes devotees, especially in the beginning, they get a little cranky that, you know, so many people telling me I have to do this, I have to do this at that time, you know. It's like I've got no freedom. I've got no spare time for Maya. And they would, you know, therefore even when Prabhupada would sometimes come to the various temples, different devotees would ask him, what about intuition? You know, serving Krishna intuitively. And, you know, sure Prabhupada would, you know, point out that, you know, that will come later. You know, it's there. But first you follow the regulative principles. And when, you know, when a person's mind is not filled up with so many crazy thoughts that blind their intelligence, then you can listen to your intuition. When the mind is filled with material desires which are blocking out intelligence, and someone's saying, oh yes, I will serve Krishna intuitively, how do they tell the little devil Fred Flintstone from the little saint Fred Flintstone? You know, they can't. Is the little devil devotee talking to me, is that the intuition, or is it this one? I just cannot. So intuition is there, but one first has to master skills which are taught, you know, in an authorized institution, which, you know, coming in one of the Vaishnav lines. How to be a Vaishnav, we learn that in an institution. Just like if you want to be an artist, you know, these days anyone will pick up a paintbrush, no lessons, you know, like this, and everyone's thinking, oh, whoa, you know, look at that, you're just so free, you know, what is it? You know? Such, you know, and then now, you know, they have monkeys, and the monkeys are also on the level of, you know, these other great artists. So you've got to wonder whether the monkey is so elevated that these artists are actually on the level of monkeys in their painting. And they have all sorts of animals and little children, you know, and they sell their paintings, seriously, monkeys. A monkey in this day and age can sell a painting for thousands and thousands of dollars. And little children. And they're considered equal with the masters. So we have to understand that some of these masters are actually, you know, not very elevated. But they're taking it the other way. Oh, these masters are so wonderful and these monkeys are equal to them. How wonderful is a monkey? But actually, if you want to learn to paint, you need to know what are the tools of the trade. So you have certain types of brushes. You have brushes with a round end, you have brushes with a flat end, you have brushes, you know, very, very fine, you have fan brushes, you have palette knives of all different shapes and size. How do you mix the colours? You get your three primary colours, and then you go to, you know, you mix the secondary colours, your tertiary colours, And with those colours, you should be able to mix every colour. And then there's different things that you mix with the paint in order to get different consistencies. There's different things that you do to the canvas, like this. When you develop that and develop your ability to mix your colours, recognise the brushes and the palettes, you know, knives that you're supposed to use, when you've done all of that and practice that, and you can think of something and put exactly on the canvas what you're thinking, then you can paint intuitively. But if you take a paintbrush and, you know, get a blob of paint and throw it from a distance and say, oh, look what happened, accidentally, and everyone says, oh, how wonderful, that's, you know, that's different. They call that intuition. We call it monkey business, you know. So, you know, intuition is there as a devotee, but, you know, the first thing is, you know, you learn, you know, shastra, you learn how to chant your rounds, you learn how to not be offensive, you know, you learn how to follow the regulative principles, you know, you learn how to dress nicely, you learn how to come into the deity room. There's so many different things, how to worship the guru. You put them all together and you can do them properly, then you can serve Krishna with intuition on a spontaneous platform like this. So, you know, these acharyas in our you know, especially in ISKCON, see, even in the other sampradayas, that's not happening, even within the sampradayas. But this is, you know, what we have to maintain, what Srila Prabhupada taught us, and we have to be very, very careful to maintain, that unless it's actually authorized by Srila Prabhupada, in Srila Prabhupada's books, you know, his writings and teachings, we should not do it. We should not speak it. We should not think it. And we have to be able to verify everything, and then once verifying everything, we have to then maintain that standard. That is a position, that's the transcendental position where one can guarantee that I'm not acting according to the sense gratification on a subtle platform with my mind. That's the only platform you can guarantee that. Otherwise, one will become a victim. Any other questions or comments? Yep.
So if one practices regular principles, chanting Hare Krishna 16 rounds, and follow the sadhana bhakti, can he be on a mode of goodness? Go to the platform or whatever?
Well, one who's actually following, chanting 16 rounds, following the regular principles, and you know, following the practices of sadhana bhakti, he's on the transcendental position by and large, but there may be some, you know, taints, mostly from the mode of goodness. You know, there's some taints, so it's not Vishuddhi sattva yet. Most is transcendental, but, you know, little pockets during the day where the modes of material nature may enter the mind and one's activities, and one's transcendental position can be a little bit impeded. You know, just little, it's not so. But by and large, they're on the transcendental path, in the transcendental position, and some little pockets of taint, the mode of goodness, and sometimes passion like that. So, we, you know, by and large, we consider them transcendental. We were discussing yesterday in the Bhakti Bhai Bhava, you know, that in Dwarka, you know, there were prostitutes, according, you know, by tricks of fate. They were also considered to be great devotees of Krishna, that, you know, because they were great devotees. By some tricks of fate, they ended up in that situation. But, you know, the predominance of their thoughts and their activities were dedicated to Krishna. So they're considered to be nicely situated on the transcendental path, even though there were some, you know, little taints or impediments that they're not taking as complete, very significant, because if someone is properly situated as a devotee, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 9th chapter, text 30, that those, you know, faults, that's the word he uses, they will, you know, quickly vanquish, be vanquished. What's the wording in that? Yeah, what's the next verse? It's that one, yeah. What's the wording to that? I don't think he used the words false there. Something will be vanquished. You know, the unrighteousness or something, right? What's the translation? And the next part? That's not he becomes righteous. The next part. But you know, the bad habits, any unrighteousness, you know, the faults or thing that becomes very quickly. You know, so you see that devotees, if they practice devotional service on the transcendental platform, that within this lifetime they can actually become fit to go back to Godhead. So, you know, throughout the course of their devotional service, sometimes, you know, they become a victim to the modes to some small degree, sometimes even very strongly. But if the devotee just keeps maintaining his devotional service, by and large they're considered on the transcendental path and on the transcendental platform, by and large, and, you know, as they go through life, they will, you know, in this one lifetime become completely free. Whereas on the other way, people who may criticize the devotees, generally what we see is the opposite, that they're on the path of bondage, and little pockets in their life they do something religious or so-called spiritual, and they make, oh yes, I am such a great transcendental person. You know, the main predominance of their life is materialistic, the modes of material nature. Couple of little pious religious ceremonies here and there, and they think, yes, I am transcendental, and they will severely criticize the devotees at this. So Krishna, no, he's not very happy with that. Jai, all good, Srila Prabhupada.